Today we're going to continue through the process of the central dogma of molecular biology. We've covered transcription. We talked about RNA and different forms of RNA and editing and RNA interference. Today we're going to talk about translation. And translation is the production of proteins based on information contained in RNA molecules. And talked a little bit the other day about there was a point in time in genetics in which there was this hypothesis, one gene, one enzyme. So the way that that was done, that scientists would, they came up with a series of mutants that were involved in the same metabolic pathway. Let me dim the lights a bit. Okay. So they came up with mutants that were involved in the same pathway, and then they would add supplement to the media that provided the bacteria or the yeast, depending on which lab they were working on or which lab we're talking about, with a nutrient that, due to the mutation, they were unable to make. Okay, so here we've got, this is the pathway that produces arginine. Okay, so there are three steps. In this production, you've got this common precursor, enzyme A, then is encoded by gene A. It makes ornithine. Enzyme B takes the ornithine and produces citrulline. Enzyme B is encoded by gene B. Then enzyme C takes the citrulline and produces arginine. And enzyme C is encoded by gene C. So what they did is a series of supplementations. And if they've got minimal media just means that you're giving the organisms the smallest amount of nutrients that you can and still have them grow on the media, that the only one that grew on it was the wild type, the one that had not been mutated. Okay. If they then provide it with ornithine, they get the wild type grows on it, and then also what they called group 1 mutants could grow on it. If they give it citrulline, the wild type group 1 and group 2 mutants grew on it. And then if they gave it arginine, then all of the wild type and all three mutants grew on it. So what this suggested is that they had a discrete mutant in each one of these, you know, a class 1, class 2, class 3. But if you look at it, it makes sense that arginine would supplement all of these classes, all three of these mutants, because you're giving it the end product. It doesn't matter where the mutation is in here. If you give it the end product, you basically bypass this whole biochemical pathway. If you give it citrulline, you're avoiding or bypassing mutations in enzyme A, enzyme B, but it doesn't help you with enzyme C because it can't convert citrulline to arginine. If you give it ornithine, you're moving back one step. That'll help you if you've a mutation in enzyme A. So they were able then to link each one of these groups of mutants to a specific gene in this biochemical pathway. And at that point, they thought, okay, what a gene does is it encodes an enzyme involved in a metabolic or biochemical pathway. Okay. You don't need to know that. I'm not going to do that to you. All right, but then at later points in time, labs started looking at structural proteins like collagen, and they found mutations in structural proteins, actin, tubulin, proteins that weren't enzymatic, that weren't involved in metabolic pathways. So they went from the idea of one gene, one enzyme, to one gene, one protein. Okay. We talked the other day about the fact that that held up true for a long period of time until alternative splicing was discovered. And once alternative splicing was discovered, then the idea of one gene, one protein went out the window. You can have one gene like ankyrin that we talked about that can produce tens of thousands of slightly different proteins. But in general, when we talk about a gene in here, many times we'll be talking about a gene that encodes a protein, ultimately. The vast majority of genes in your genome encode a protein. Okay? So it's fair to think about them encoding a protein. We just can't think about one gene will always encode just a single protein. Most of them do, but not all of them. Right? So today we're going to talk about the process by which that happens. Okay? Transcription should make sense. I mean, at a fundamental level, it's a process that's fairly similar to replication. It's just that you're producing RNA molecules as the output instead of DNA. You're taking essentially the same information and you're just converting it to a slightly different nucleic acid. Okay? So transcription's not that big of a trick. Translation, on the other hand, is a big change. You're taking information and now you're converting it to something functional. We're going to look at information in an mRNA molecule and will produce a protein of a very specific amino acid sequence. And it was is fairly hard for scientists to elucidate how that happened. So what they start doing is once the connection had been made, you've got a gene that encodes a protein, genes produce RNA, then they start looking at if the sequence of RNA directed the sequence of a protein. So what they would do is they synthesized an RNA molecule that was just made up of uracils. It was a poly-U. It's referred to as a homopolymer. It's made up of all the same base. And they put that in a system in which they add this mRNA, and there are cell-free translation systems that can be used in a lab. You can stick ribosomes and some supplementary material in a tube, and you can add RNA to it and translate it. They're not used as much these days. When I first started in grad school, if you wanted to positively demonstrate that a gene that you had produced a certain protein, you would clone that gene, stick it into an in vitro transcription translation system with a radio label, and then you would show the mass of the protein that was produced, and you could characterize it if you wanted. They don't do that anymore. They've got some nice alternatives to that. But that's basically what they did. They put this in with one. They set up 20 tubes where it had 19 unlabeled amino acid and one labeled amino acid. Okay. And they went to see which of these would produce a protein that had a label. And when you use poly-U, what they saw was they produced phenylalanine, that they had a protein that was just a polymer of radio-labeled phenylalanine. So that suggested that it's not a random process, that a RNA molecule of all U's would produce a polymeric protein of phenylalanines. Okay. So that indicated to them that the sequence of a protein was directed by the sequence of the mRNA molecule that was used in translation. All right, so with this one, what they were looking at is how that information is converted. And what they did was with tRNA molecules, remember oftentimes they'll be depicted as an upside down clover leaf. They've got tRNA molecules here that are carrying different amino acids, and they would add them to ribosomes. And if they had a short mRNA molecule, they could tag or they could track which RNA molecule would adhere to the ribosome when a short mRNA molecule was attached. And what they found is tRNA molecules have a sequence at the bottom. We'll look at that in more detail in a bit. It's called an anticodon. And they will form base pairs to three nucleotides of the mRNA molecule while it's being held by the ribosome. And so the sequence is dictated by attracting the appropriate transfer RNA molecule. So they determine that. And so they had this information that it probably was three nucleotides that was bringing in or recruiting the tRNA molecule. And that was one of the problems that biologists had to overcome was you've got information that's maintained in a molecule that only has four bases. Okay? So you've got four possible bases that could be at any position, but proteins, you've got 20 amino acids that could be at any one position. Okay? So how does a molecule with less variation come up with a molecule that has greater? How does it encode for a molecule with greater information? Okay? So you guys have grown up in an age in which you're used to the idea of thinking about codes, like binary code, that you can stick a lot of ones and zeros together. There's very little variation in binary code with ones and zeros, but if you stick enough together, you can make that informative. Okay. So if you have... if you just have an encoding region of one nucleotide, you've got four possible options. So this is nucleotide, these are amino acids. Okay. So if you have something that's one nucleotide long, you could reasonably come up with variation of four amino acids. If you have an mRNA sequence that's two nucleotides in length, you've got four at each of the two positions, you've got 16 possibilities. We're close to 20, but we're not quite at 20. Okay? But if you have a nucleotide sequence that's three long, you've got 64 possible sequences. They could reasonably encode for 64 unique amino acids. There's only 20. We've got coverage with a nucleotide sequence of three nucleotides long. And that was consistent with what they saw with the tRNA ribosome binding, is a window of three nucleotides in length. Okay. So they did studies in that were similar to that polyuracil, where then they started putting in triplets. They would put one triplet in, followed after another triplet after another, and they would see that they could guide the translation of the protein to a specific sequence. So then it became a matter of deciphering which triplet of mRNA encoded which amino acid. Okay? We refer to these three nucleotides that encode for an amino acid as a codon. Okay? And that's a phrase that's worth memorizing. All right, let's look at... okay, so here's what's going on. Then we'll come back and talk about some of the terminology in a minute. So inside of the ribosome will hold the mRNA in place, and the codon will be exposed. The codon is a sequence of three nucleotides on the mRNA molecule. And this codon is exposed. Here's a tRNA molecule. tRNA molecules at the bottom of one of their cloverleaf structures have three nucleotides called the anticodon. So the codon is on mRNA, anticodon is on tRNA. Okay. And the anticodon on the tRNA molecule will form base pairs with the complementary bases. So if we've got a codon here that's UCC, if we've got an anticodon that's AGG, it will form base pairs, and that will stabilize that interaction. Okay. And these tRNA molecules have different anticodons depending on which amino acid they are bound to. Okay. So you've got specific tRNA molecules for serine. Okay. But if we go back, that there's some degeneracy in the code that... the same amino acid can be, we've got 64 possible combinations and only 20 amino acids. So you can have more than one anticodon and codon that will bring in the same amino acid. Okay. So let's... when they did all these experiments and figured out the genetic code, you will see this or something similar to this, you know, on your homework assignments. If you need it on the exam, you don't need to memorize this. If you get to grad school, you have to memorize this. If you go into genetics, my PhD comprehensive exam, one of my committee members gave me a stretch of about 240 nucleotides, and I thought, oh, he's going to ask me to translate this. I got it. He slid it to me, and then he wanted me to take it like a step or two further, that it actually, you can get, depending on where you start on a sequence, you can, in which direction you go, you could get six possible reading frames. He wanted me to produce the proteins from all six possible reading frames and calculate their approximate isoelectric focusing point as proteins. I got it right. They're close enough that he gave up grading it. So, when you're a PhD candidate, your thesis is an afterthought, because at that point you've worked on a project for 5 or 6 years. You know more about that project than anybody else in the room. And so committees rarely jerk you around on your thesis project. If you're a PhD candidate, your big thing is your comprehensive exam that happens about 2.5 years in, and you will see people go gray in their 20s during their comprehensive exam. So, but it's kind of like doctors studying for boards. You know, it's med school. Once you get into med school, you're more than likely to pass med school, but boards is another thing altogether. Anyway, I'm not going to be a pain in the butt and make you guys memorize this yet, but if you stay here for grad school and you want to study genetics, I will. So they determined, here are the codons. These are showing the codons that are associated with a particular amino acid. There are a few that I want you to memorize. There are four on here that I want you to memorize. The first is AUG. And here it's just shown as a codon for methionine. Okay? But 99.99%, actually even further out than that, of all proteins, the first amino acid is methionine. And it's because this codon acts as an initiation codon. So we casually refer to AUG as a start codon. Okay, but it also encodes for methionine. So when it starts translation, it's going to bring in a methionine. So if you just look at most proteins, the first one, the one at the amino terminus, is a methionine. Right? So I will stop here real briefly to make a point on which I will hammer away between now and exam 3. And that is, while the processes of transcription and translation are coupled, right? But in eukaryotes, we've got this nuclear membrane across from it. RNA polymerase and ribosome don't give a rat's ass what the other one looks for in starting and stopping. Okay? The biggest mistake that you can make on these homeworks and on this exam is think that ribosomes will look for the transcription start site and will start translating there. They don't. They have their own things that they look for. RNA polymerase does not look for a AUG codon and start transcribing there. Okay? RNA polymerase looks for completely different things when determining when to initiate and when to terminate than do ribosomes. So don't fall in that trap of you make an RNA molecule, the ribosome is going to start at the end. The ribosome is going to start at an AUG codon. Okay, so an AUG codon is important in your world in that respect. The other three that I want you to know are stop or termination codons. They don't encode for an amino acid. Unlike AUG, it starts it and it adds an amino acid. The ones that stop translation don't add a terminal amino acid. Okay? They just result in translation stopping. And those are UAA, UAG, and UGA. Those are the three stop codons. I want you to know those four codons, that's the only thing that you have to know from this table. But some things to look for here, if you look, there are quite a few amino acids where there are four different codons that will encode for the same amino acid. Okay, we refer to that as degeneracy, that, you know, more than one codon encodes for an amino acid. But what I want you to notice, if we look at this chart, with the exception of this block here, they're either all four codons that have the same first and second bases in them encode for the same amino acid, or we've got the boxes split in two, where if you've got the same two nucleotides here, that they'll encode for one amino acid, these two will code for another. And if you look, it's typically split by if the third nucleotide is a pyrimidine or a purine. So here we've got UU pyrimidine is phenylalanine, UU purine is leucine. Okay. And the reason for that is a process called wobble. And when you see those pictures of a tRNA molecule and they look like a clover leaf, okay, I want you to think a little bit like mRNA is being stretched out in the ribosome. Okay, so I've brought up the point that you rarely see nucleic acids straightened out. The one time that you really do is mRNA in a ribosome is being stretched out like a tape and it's being read. Okay, but then you've got this curved tRNA molecule, and it's sort of like the bottom of a rocking chair. And we've got three nucleotides that we're trying to sit down on a curved molecule and match them up with a straight molecule. And you can line up two of them pretty well, but if you line up those two pretty well, the third one is sticking up and away from the molecule. And so as a result, the third nucleotide in these codons is often insignificant. Or it's significant in the sense of, does it have one ring or two? Okay, and that's referred to as wobble. So here's, their showing goes on, that sometimes you can have a slight mismatch at that third position with a tRNA molecule. You'll still bring in the right amino acid, but you're not getting an exact match. The AG binding to the UC here are the ones that really clamp it down, and that third one sticking up in the air a little bit, and it's not as important. So when you look at that table, it really is the first two nucleotides, and then whether it's a purine or pyrimidine in some of these cases. Okay? And that's the idea of wobble. So through wobble, a single anticodon can bind with more than one codon. But remember, it's the codon that's driving which amino acid is there. Okay. So revisiting that one gene, one enzyme, that got switched to the one gene, one polypeptide when they brought in structural molecules. All right. But you can imagine that if you've got an RNA molecule, depending on which nucleotide you start at, you can have at least three different proteins produced. If you start at position one and you read every three, you would have one protein. If you start at position two and read every three, you would have another. If you start at position three and read every three, you would have a third protein. And we refer to those as reading frames. There are three frames, depending on whether you start with one, two, or three, and go down in groups of three. So when you see an mRNA molecule, always think of codons once you start translating. In fact, old geneticists like me, when we were doing sequencing, it's back in the old days when we had to lyse bacteria by banging them between rocks down at the stream, and centrifuges had yet to be invented and stuff like that. Sorry, I'm legally obligated to tell you how tough science was when I was a student. It's just part of the job. We didn't have really nice computer software when we did sequencing, and so I had, I don't know if they make them anymore, sheets of graph paper that were about 24 to 30 inches wide, and they were about 18 inches high. And when we did sequencing gels, we would just go through and look at the gels and write down the nucleotide sequence on these huge pieces of graph paper. Then if we were looking for overlapping sequences, we could slide our graph paper down along sequences that we already had and try to find them. So DNA analysis software saves a lot of time. But when you would take your information, your sequence off of the graph paper and enter it into the computer, you just got in the habit of working with triplets. As a geneticist, you would just do. And so you can always tell an old geneticist, if you have them read a nucleotide sequence, they will tend to read it in triplets. If you ever want to identify an old geneticist so you can hit them over the head with a board and put them out of their misery or something. Anyway, so when you see an mRNA molecule, what's that? Man, that's a lot of bludgeoning in here because I was beating grad students or something the other day in a story. So when you see mRNA, think in terms of triplets, and they won't overlap. So you have 1, 2, 3. Okay. Now what the trick is, okay, it will either be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. It won't be 1, 2, 3, 2, 3, 4, 3, 4, 5. They won't overlap by a single one. You don't go slide one nucleotide down and define the next triplet. You always move over three at a time. And so what the trick is in determining which reading frame is important is determining whether it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Whether you're starting at 1, starting at 2, or starting at 3, these are three different reading frames. Okay, so anytime that you have a series of triplets on an mRNA molecule, they are a reading frame. If you have a reading frame that, if you look at these specific nucleotides and take it back to this table, you could take a sequence from an mRNA molecule and use this to do basically a translation, predict which sequence would produce which amino acid. If on paper you have a sequence that produces a relatively large number of amino acids before you get to stop codons, that's referred to as an open reading frame. When people analyze genomes, one of the first things that the software does is it takes the DNA sequence, converts it to mRNA sequences, and then looks at this codon usage table and predicts whether that stretch of DNA could predict or could produce a protein. And they do so by predicting open reading frames. Okay, so when you get a lot of proteins, it doesn't happen just randomly. Okay, so typically if you get a long stretch that looks like it encodes amino acids, a lot of amino acids without a stop codon, that's a good indication that it actually does that. If you just throw random nucleotides in here, you hit a stop codon pretty quickly. Okay, about every 18 or 20 positions would be a stop codon. Okay. Now, this code that they came up with is, it's oftentimes referred to as the universal code. It's actually a near universal code that most organisms on the planet use this same table. There are some microorganisms that are different. Mitochondria have their own rules, so some mitochondria use slightly different codon usage. But the vast majority of organisms on the planet. So I could Take a look at your DNA using this table. I can take a look at E. coli using this table and predict proteins that would be made. Okay, so we're going to start bringing the players together now, or give you the cast of players, and we'll talk about the molecular mechanism and how it plays out. The first is tRNA molecules, that they are bound to a specific amino acid. Okay? Depending on the anticodon at the bottom, there will be a specific amino acid attached to it. Okay? And that process is referred to as charging, tRNA charging. When the tRNA molecule gets covalently linked to the appropriate amino acid that it should deliver. Remember, tRNA molecules, their job is to deliver the appropriate amino acid to the ribosome. Okay? And this takes place in the cytoplasm, and there are 20 enzymes that will charge each amino acid to the appropriate tRNA molecules. Let's see if we got it. Nope. There's not a nice picture of it. So what happens is there's an enzyme, and it basically has an active site that will interact with the anticodon and interact with one of the sidearms of a tRNA molecule. And if the tRNA molecule coming in has the one of the appropriate anticodons, it will stay in the active site long enough to be modified. And by modified means that we put the appropriate amino acid at that acceptor arm. Remember, the acceptor arms are at the 3' end of the tRNA molecule. So it happens by a very specific enzymatic step. And they're referred to, the enzymes are referred to as aminoacyl tRNA, that should be synthetases. But there's a specific enzyme that does it. That's what I want you to know, that these molecules just don't interact and randomly form. The tRNA molecule can be recycled. So after it delivers the amino acid to the ribosome, it will be released. It can go back out, get recharged, and come back again. So tRNA molecules are constantly shuttling amino acids to the ribosome. Okay? They get charged. They go to the ribosomes. They then have the amino acid taken away. They go back out and get recharged. Okay. So it's depending on the way that you think, it's either really good or really unfortunate for you, but the three major steps of translation are named exactly the same that they were in transcription. We're going to have initiation, elongation, and termination. Okay? But again, keep in mind that the way that a ribosome initiates is entirely different than the way that an RNA polymerase will initiate. But they both will initiate. So we'll talk about initiation. Okay, and this is ribosome binding and assembly. So it's binding to the mRNA molecule. All right, so ribosomes they're made up of a large number of molecules. Ribosomal RNA, but then also small proteins. But there are two major subunits to a ribosome, the large subunit, the small subunit, and they don't hang out together when they're not translating. It's one of the misconceptions of lower-level biology is that people think ribosomes just sort of float along, already assembled, ready to go. A ribosome kind of looks like a hamburger bun or a hot dog bun, in which one half of the bun is much larger than the other half. Okay? So you got a ribosome, when they're together, will look something like that. Okay? But the bun's not assembled until the hot dog is around. Okay, so that's one of the things to keep in mind. So on initiation, when I talk about assembly, we're putting the ribosome together around mRNA. Okay. So that's the charging. So here we've got the two halves of the ribosome. Okay. Depending on whether you're talking about prokaryotes or eukaryotes, they've got different size designation, but we've got the large and the small subunits. Okay, the way that things initiate is there are specific initiation factors. We've got initiation factor 3 that's bound to the small subunit. Okay. And here's our mRNA molecule. There are specific sequences just upstream of the AUG start codon. Okay. In this case, we're looking at a prokaryotic system, and the sequence, the initiation sequence, is called the Shine-Delgarno sequence. It's named after two scientists. You used to be able to name stuff after yourself when you're a scientist. It's kind of frowned upon now. All the big things have already been named. I think Okazaki was one of the last guys to get his name on something. So this Shine-Delgarno sequence, it actually kind of wraps around this small subunit of the ribosome. So we've got the small subunit. The mRNA molecule sort of wraps around, and the Shine-Delgarno is right here at this turn that it starts to make. And that positions the start codon at a very specific location. So the Shine-Delgarno tends to be spaced at a conserved distance in organisms. So in E. coli, it tends to be about 8 nucleotides upstream of the start codon. Remember, this is an mRNA molecule. And in bacteria, when I give you samples on homework or tests, I will give them to you in a prokaryotic system because it's more straightforward. Okay, so you want to look for a sequence AGG, AGG, or something similar to that, an AG-rich sequence about 8 bases upstream of an AUG. And that, along with the initiation factor, that the initiation factor binds to this end of the small subunit, it helps attract the Shine-Delgarno sequence. Much like in the prokaryotic system where there's a consensus sequence to the promoter for transcription, the closer you are to the consensus sequence for Shine-Delgarno, the stronger you will attract ribosomes. If you've got something that varies from this quite a bit, if you've got like AGC, ACG, that would be a fairly weak initiation sequence, so you wouldn't have as many ribosomes bind to it. You would translate at a lower level. Okay? The closer you are to that AGG, AGG, the more rounds of translation that you're going to get. And just like I told you, not to think in terms of one RNA polymerase molecule on a gene that there are others backed up one after the other, one after the other. If you've got a strong Shine-Delgarno sequence and you're an mRNA molecule, after this ribosome starts elongation, you'll have another ribosome that will come in and initiate. And you'll get a string of multiple ribosomes on the same mRNA molecule. Okay. So this strength of this sequence determines whether or not initiation takes place, and if so, how frequently that takes place. Okay. So now we've got the AUG here in a specific site. And at that point, here comes our tRNA molecule that comes in that's complementary. Remember, there's only one codon for methionine. It's really the exception to that table that there's just a single codon for methionine. And so we've got the tRNA for methionine, but in this case, the methionine's been modified. It's got N-formal methionine. So the amino acid itself has been modified slightly. And it comes in and it forms base pairs between the anticodon and the codon, and that's stabilized for a brief period of time by those hydrogen bonds. We've got initiation factor 2 that's involved. Okay, you don't need to obsess about that. But it does require energy. We've got a GTP molecule that's similar to ATP. It's a molecule of biological energy. It takes energy to initiate, to assemble this structure. Okay? At that point then, the GTP's given off. We lose these initiation factors. And the large subunit of the ribosome comes in and sits down on top of this mRNA small subunit tRNA complex. Okay? And so that's how initiation takes place. The last piece that comes in is that large subunit. So don't think in terms of a ribosome being already in place and an mRNA molecule is threaded into it. That's not the way it happens. It's assembled. The ribosome is assembled around the initiation sequence and the start codon. Okay. And the reason for that, well, here's just some terminology. If you're in prokaryotes, the initiation sequence is called the Shine-Dalgarno. In eukaryotes, it's called the Kozak sequence. And the Kozak sequence actually overlaps the AUG in eukaryotes. When I give you examples, they'll be prokaryotic, so you'll be looking for a Shine-Dalgarno about 8 nucleotides upstream. Okay. All right, so that's initiation. We've now assembled the ribosome. We've got a tRNA holding a methionine that's bound by base pairs to the AUG. We're ready to move on to the next step, which is elongation. And in elongation, that's where we'll just read the mRNA molecule and add the next appropriate amino acid. Okay? But there are three sites in the ribosomes that you need to know, the E, the P, and the A. Okay. And the E site is the exit site. So this is where empty tRNA molecules leave. Okay. You get a tRNA molecule, and it's already handed off its amino acid. When it gets to the E site, that's the door out. Just like when you enter a theater, you see the exit signs, or in this room, the exit. That's the way that it leaves the ribosome and can go out and get charged again. Okay. The P site is peptidyl is its technical name. Okay. But this is where the vast majority of time the growing protein chain will be. Okay. And it will be attached to a tRNA molecule at the P site. Okay, so at the P site, we've got a tRNA molecule, and the growing polypeptide chain is being held to that tRNA molecule. Okay, and the A site is the aminoacyl site. And this is where the next amino acid will enter, and again, it's attached to a tRNA molecule. So the E site, the spent tRNA leaves. The P site is where we'll see the growing protein attached to a tRNA. And the A site is where the tRNA molecules will enter from the outside, bringing that next amino acid. Okay. So here's how that plays out. Let me see if we got a bigger picture. No. Okay, so here's what happened during initiation. Okay, we've got our initiation tRNA, it's got the modified methionine on it. It's sitting at the AUG, and that happens at the P site. Okay. The ribosome had to be assembled around the tRNA-mRNA complex, because there's no way, if you assemble the ribosome around the mRNA without the tRNA there, there's no way for a tRNA to go immediately to that P site. And we need the start tRNA molecule to be present at the P site when we start elongation. So that's why we had to build this structure around the mRNA-tRNA complex. It's because there's no way to get from the outside directly to the P site. The only way you can build it so that it's built into the P site. Okay? So our E site is empty. We've got this tRNA that's bound. All of these interactions between the mRNA and the tRNA will be codon-anticodon base pairing. All of them will be maintained by that. Okay? So if a tRNA molecule comes in with the wrong anticodon, it can try to interact, but it won't be complementary, so that won't be stabilized for long enough for the ribosome to do its job. But in these diagrams, they tend to show you it's always just the right tRNA that comes in. No, the wrong ones come in a lot, but they just don't form those hydrogen bonds that stabilize them long enough for the enzymatic reaction to take place. Okay? So we've got this at the P site. The A site is open. tRNA molecules can come in from the outside into the A site. We've got a CCC codon. Then we've got a tRNA molecule that's got a GGG anticodon. They're an exact match. That's going to be a good fit. So it comes in from the outside into the A site. Okay. So now we've got, this one is technically our growing chain. It's just that we've got a chain of one right now. We've got the next amino acid. We use some energy. I'm not going to get into the elongation factors too much here. You can get into them in MolBio. But the tRNA just doesn't come in alone. It's got some helper proteins, and there's energy involved. And I mentioned repeatedly through the semester, you don't want to make proteins if you don't have to, because it costs a lot of energy. Every time that you add an amino acid to a chain, it costs you a GTP molecule. So they get positioned side by side, and then there's a enzymatic step where covalently the carboxyl end of the protein that's at the P site is connected to the amino group of the amino acid. Okay? You always add the next amino acid onto the carboxyl terminus of the growing protein. So proteins always grow from amino to carboxyl termini. So that means the last amino acid added is at the carboxyl terminus or the C terminus. Okay. And at the amino terminus, that's going to be the first one added, so that's, again, almost always a methionine. Okay? So when you add these new amino acids, you're growing the protein chain at the carboxyl terminus. Okay? So making a covalent bond between the amino group of the last amino acid added to the carboxyl terminus of the growing chain. And for a brief period of time, that takes place. This is transferred. So this growing peptide, once that covalent bond is formed, for a very brief moment in time, the growing polypeptide is at the A site. So this tRNA molecule that brought in the glycine, the methionine gets transferred over to it. It gets bound to it. And for a brief period of time, this tRNA molecule is holding the growing peptide at the A site. Then what happens is the entire ribosome slides down three nucleotides. Okay? And that puts this empty initiation tRNA molecule at the exit site. It can just slide out the back door. Now our growing polypeptide chain is at the P site, and the A site is empty. And at that point, the next tRNA molecule can come in. That leaves an ACG at the codon. And so a tRNA molecule with a complementary anticodon can come in, and the process will be repeated. When that tRNA molecule is stabilized by the codon-anticodon binding, then the ribosome will transfer this methionine glycine growing polypeptide to that site, make the covalent bond, and then the whole ribosome will slide over three nucleotides. And that's what happens at elongation. So you ought to understand these three sites, what's happening at each of the steps, and what can be found at each of at these sites during the process. Okay? But when it's not enzymatically being added, the growing polypeptide chain will be at the P, but right after the enzymatic step, the growing polypeptide chain is very briefly at the A site. That tells the ribosome it's time to move over. Okay. All right, so that's elongation. And that repeats as long as you've got a codon on the mRNA that will interact with a tRNA molecule that brings in an amino acid. You just keep repeating that over and over again until termination takes place. And remember that there are those three special codons, the stop codons, UAA, UAG, and UGA. And they help signal the termination, but there's also proteins called release factors that are involved. All right, so here they're showing you everything that's going on. Let me see if we've just got a picture of the release factor. This is initiation, elongation. All right, so what happens when you get to a stop codon, there are release factors that recognize the codons, the stop codons. Okay? And there are no tRNAs that correspond to stop codons. Okay? There are tRNA molecules that will interact with every other codon, but there shouldn't be any that correspond to stop codons. There are some mutations that take place in which a gene encoding a tRNA molecule will be mutated, and all of a sudden you'll have a tRNA molecule that will bring in an amino acid instead of leaving a stop codon empty. And you get these proteins that don't end at the right spot, so they tend to be fairly severe mutations. Okay? But a release factor comes in and it binds at the A site to a stop codon, and that binding of the release factor at the A site signals the entire complex to dissociate. So at that point, the ribosomal subunits fall apart. The growing polypeptide chain will release from the tRNA molecule, and the mRNA will be released. Okay? So the release factor, basically, once it binds, it blows up the whole thing. The protein's released. The molecules are separated, and the process can begin again. And actually, the process is probably happening right behind it already. There's another ribosome following right down here. But there's no tRNA molecules, specialized proteins called release factors that recognize those three codons, and that's what forces termination in translation. Termination in transcription is a pretty gentle process. Remember, it's just the RNA polymerase gets goosed from behind a little bit by a stem loop structure, and it just lets go. But in translation, we're actually pretty quickly and violently dissociating all of these interactions that we form during initiation and elongation. Okay, so make sure that you're good on the three steps and generally what's going on at the three sites of the ribosome. Okay, and then we've got the peptide being released. We've got a complete protein at that point. And again, that mRNA molecule is probably already being used by other ribosomes that are following down it, particularly in a prokaryotic system, that's very common. And that's referred to as a polyribosome. when you've got an mRNA molecule that is being translated at the same time by multiple ribosomes. Let's see if we got a picture. Those of you that are really good at thinking in three dimensions, here's your porn for the day. Those of you who aren't, my world and welcome to it. I have to accept that I was freakishly good at those things where you, the magic eyes. I could look into those, but other things, I can't look at those ribbon drawings and get a sense of three dimensions at all. So that's why I'm not a biochemist. All right, so there are a few other processes that we need to talk about. Let's see. This is, so if for some reason the ribosome just stalls out on the mRNA molecule, that's not a good thing. Okay, you've got an mRNA molecule that's carrying information. You want proteins, and now you've got a ribosome that's stopped on it. Okay, it's kind of like if somebody's blocking a lane of traffic at rush hour. Okay, you back things up. It's not good. So there's a specific mechanism that the cell has to deal with a ribosome that is stalled out. And so it could just be that something happened, it missed the stop codon, or that there was a mutant tRNA that didn't recognize a stop codon, and the ribosome makes it to the end of an mRNA molecule, and it just hangs out there. Okay, the release factor is what blows the thing up, and so it doesn't have that ability to dissociate. Or sometimes an RNA molecule could be damaged or chewed up, and the stop codon has been deleted. And so if you had those and they just kept initiating and elongating, but they wouldn't terminate, those things would basically titrate out all the ribosomes that they would bind. They would be the Roach Motel for ribosomes. Ribosomes check in, but they don't check out. And so you need to liberate those ribosomes so that they can carry out their function. So there's a special molecule called a tmRNA. It's a little bit transfer RNA. It's a little bit messenger RNA. You guys are far too young to remember when Donnie and Marie Osmond had their own show, but their theme song was, "I'm a little bit country, he's a little bit rock and roll." This molecule is a little bit tRNA and mRNA. It's got a tRNA component built right into the molecule, but the other part of it looks a lot like mRNA. And so this special molecule comes in and inserts itself to the end of the ribosome at the A site, so that that tRNA component gets into the A site, and that forces the ribosome to start moving again. Okay, and it's got this extended sort of looks like a paperclip. It goes out and then it comes back and it braces itself on the ribosome. And so now the ribosome can slide down the mRNA component of the tmRNA. Okay, it's been had the charged tRNA molecule goes into the A site, so then it can enzymatically bind that. And it's almost always an alanine. That there have been a couple organisms found where it's a glycine, but it's almost always an alanine that's at the tRNA component of the molecule. And then it slides down the mRNA part of it, and then there's a stop codon that's present in the mRNA component of this molecule. So it gives the ribosome another chance to, if it missed the stop codon before, or it gives it its first chance to encounter a stop codon if it's an mRNA molecule with the deletion. It then slides up on that stop codon at the A site, and then hopefully then the release factors will bind to it and blow up the protein. The problem is you've now made a protein that does not have the right amino acid sequence, right? Which is generally not a good thing to have floating around in a cell. Okay, it may be inactive, but it may have altered activity that's something that you don't want. So this molecule is a pretty crafty bugger. What it does is it encodes a very specific sequence of amino acids on that mRNA part of the molecule, and they act as a molecular tag inside the cell. The only proteins that should have this at their carboxyl end are ones that have been produced as a result of this tmRNA activity. And it serves as a tag or a flag for these proteins to be broken down rapidly. So you don't have these altered proteins that have the wrong sequence. It's like, okay, we had to make this thing to get the ribosomes loose, but we don't want this thing to be functional, so chew it up as quickly as you can. So that mRNA portion of the molecule encodes a very specific flag for that entire protein to be degraded rapidly. But you can imagine if you've got a mutation and your gene is terminating, okay, so the RNA is being produced without a stop codon. If for some reason you would get a mutation that would produce a transcription terminator before you would encode the stop codon, every time that gene's expressed, all of its mRNA would have this problem. And so those mutations are very severe. You don't get any functional protein produced because the ribosomes always stall out. All the proteins get that tag, and they're all degraded. Okay. All right, so know all of this. That's the bad side about me going short, is pretty much everything I talked about today is knowable information. A reminder, there's homework online today. It will be due Tuesday, but it will be a transcription translation. If for some reason when you download the file, if it doesn't include the codon usage table, use the codon usage table from your book or go online. Some people, depending on which software they have, they see it or don't see it. Don't try to do it by memory. Use the codon usage table. But remember, the ribosome is looking for a Shinedel Garno and an AUG. It's not looking for the transcription start site. All right, have a good day. Genetic exclusive since I was like 4. Got this.